From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Tatiana Voroshko, senior editor in VOA's Ukrainian service. Our topic on this edition of the program, Russia's disinformation campaign in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Our guest, Alina Polyakova. She's the David Rubenstein Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution, and that's a distinguished think tank based here in Washington. Alina specializes in Russian foreign policy, European politics, and far-right populism and nationalism. She has also written extensively on Russian political warfare, Ukraine, and transatlantic relations. Her most recent article, Social Media's Half Measures, published in The American Interest, asserts that social media giants Facebook, Twitter, and Google are not offering real solutions to address Moscow's well-documented efforts to manipulate social media during the 2016 U.S. election. Data shows that Kremlin-paid actors sow division among Americans with fake pages and accounts, inflammatory posts, and thousands of paid ads aimed at both liberal and conservative audiences. A U.S. intelligence assessment released earlier this year concluded the Kremlin developed a clear preference for Republican candidate, now President, Donald Trump, over his Democratic opponent, Hillary Clinton. In fact, a new analysis of Twitter data shows Moscow-backed support for Donald Trump's candidacy over social media began much earlier than previously known. A Wall Street Journal analysis shows that Russian Twitter accounts posing as Americans began lavishing praise on Mr. Trump and attacking his rivals within weeks after he announced his bid for the presidency in June 2015. Facebook, Twitter, and Google attorneys testified before the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee and the Senate and House Intelligence Committees this month about their platform's role in Russian interference in the 2016 elections. Facebook says as many as 126 million users received content from fake Russian sources. Twitter tried to downplay the amount of deceptive Russian material as a percentage of the platform's massive total volume. Alina Polyakova argues that the ads showed that the Russians launched a sophisticated information operation that required a nuanced understanding of American society and culture. A troll farm in St. Petersburg, known as the Internet Research Agency, IRA, spent only $46,000 on the ads in the lead-up to the elections, but obviously to great effect. Several independent researchers say that Facebook likely has the ability to search for data that could substantiate allegations of possible collusion between Russian disinformation operations and the Trump campaign's social media efforts. The possible sharing of content, the timing of social media posts, and other forensic information known only to the company could help answer questions central to congressional investigations and the probe led by Special Counsel Robert Mueller. Well, we'll talk with Alina Polyakova about the nature, extent, and impact of the Russian disinformation campaign in the United States and what can and should be done by the U.S. government, the social media platforms themselves, and users of such platforms to combat such attempts to undermine U.S. democracy. And Alina joins us now from a studio at the Brookings Institution. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Carol.
And I'm really delighted to welcome my colleague Tatiana Voroshko from VOA's Ukrainian service.
Hi.
Well, Alina, with that introduction, I'm going to ask you a very direct question. What is your take on the nature, extent, and impact of Russia's disinformation campaign in the run-up to and during the 2016 U.S. presidential elections, and how seriously should we take this phenomenon?
I think there's at least two different things going on here. On the first hand, the extent of Russian penetration of the social media networks is actually quite shocking. Some of the numbers you mentioned in your introduction, I think really need to let those sink in. In the congressional testimony just recently, Facebook representative admitted that in fact, it was 150 million accounts, if you include Instagram, which is, of course, owned by Facebook, into the count. 150 million Americans saw some ads that were posted or content that was produced by Russian-linked sources. That's especially shocking when we also learned how little money these accounts spent on these advertising campaigns. That was only $100,000, according to Facebook. So what we're seeing is that with very little, the Russians were able to accomplish quite a lot in terms of getting divisive imagery, divisive content in front of the eyes of many, many Americans, and that this was micro-targeted to very specific states, to very specific demographic groups, and then the content was really designed and tailored to try to seduce or influence those specific groups in a very strategic way. So I think that's number one. And this is just Facebook. You know, Twitter also had some quite shocking revelations of its own, as did Google. In my view, what we've learned so far is just really the tip of the iceberg. I think there's a lot more here that these tech firms probably could know or do know or will still need to find out about what the Russian government and other proxies of the Russian government have done to try to influence Americans and sow dissent and confusion in our society. So that's the bad news. I think on the other hand, we shouldn't give too much credit to this Russian campaign in the sense that in any of the findings by the intelligence community or the recent revelations from these congressional testimonies from the social media firms, nowhere is it clear that these efforts had a real impact on the outcome of the election. Frankly, my personal view, I don't think they did, because if they did, then that's when we really have to get worried about what our democracy means if it can be manipulated with, you know, $100,000 on Facebook. But I think the Russians were probably themselves surprised to how effective this campaign was in terms of how many people saw it. I think in terms of how many real accounts, primarily owned by American citizens, followed some of these troll accounts, the fake accounts, how many people liked these things on Facebook, joined these fake groups, etc. So I think what we're seeing from the Russian side is that, yes, this was coordinated, but on the other hand, it was relatively minimal. I think it was really a trial balloon by the Russians. They could have done a lot more from what we know about their cyber capabilities and what they've been doing in Ukraine, for example. They could have attacked our infrastructure. They could have done a lot more in terms of hacking operations that they didn't do. So I really think this was just a test run, a trial balloon. But that also means that, you know, looking forward, there's a lot more that could still happen and that we will need to prepare for if we really want to make sure that we're not in a situation again where a foreign actor can interfere in our electoral processes.
It appears that attorneys for Twitter, Facebook, Google are paying attention about how their platforms were misused by a foreign actor, Russia, for the purpose of influencing the U.S. presidential election. So the question to you is, do you think they are prepared to make significant changes to the way they operate in order to forestall, to prevent this type of interference in the future?
I certainly hope so. I don't think it's in the interest of any of these companies to be tools for disinformation and other types of influence operations by Russia or any malicious actor. They don't want to be part of undermining democracies. All of them said that very clearly in their congressional testimonies as well. So far, however, I haven't seen these firms make a real good faith effort to do much about it. Facebook certainly has released what it calls the action plan against foreign interference. But if you really read, which it's open to anybody to read online, what that entails, it means Facebook agrees to cooperate with congressional inquiries in the future. That's a good thing. They want to hire more people on the technical side, also on the content review side, to be able to shut down accounts, identify fake accounts more quickly, and be able to pick up similarly coordinated campaigns in the future. That's also a good thing. But I think at the end of the day, their revenue model, just like the revenue model for Twitter and also, you know, Google and Google's product YouTube, that revenue model is based on ad dollars. And what we saw was that it's been reported that companies like Twitter actually sought out accounts from RT. They actually tried to sell their services to formerly Russia Today, the Russian-sponsored news media outlet that's basically a propaganda outlet. And they try to sell their services because they want that ad revenue. And I think they don't want to admit, for example, how many of their accounts are bot, which are these, you know, automated accounts, how many of their accounts are trolls, which are, you know, human-made fake accounts, or some mixture of the two. Because at the end of the day, who wants to advertise to a bunch of fake accounts? I don't see any company wanting to do that. So I think they really need to come to terms with how they're looking at their business models. And that's going to be a really, really hard thing for these companies to do.
Let me turn to my colleague for a question.
Yeah, Elena, I'd like to go back to the first point you made about the discrepancy of how little money Russia spent and how many people saw the posts of the ads. Do you think it's just because chaos is cheap, or this is because we just don't have the full information about the extent of Russian efforts online?
We don't know what we don't know, right? We know what these companies have told us so far, but in the public space, in the open source domain, all we know is what they've put out there in their congressional testimonies and elsewhere. I do think chaos is cheap. And that's just the nature of our digital environment. You know, it's not expensive to buy ads online. There's been a sort of democratization of influence with the advent of new media technologies, the digital revolution. I mean, you think about how before we had the internet, before we had social media, you know, how much slower information traveled, first of all, how much more expensive it would have been to mount such an influence operation. Maybe it would have taken buying, you know, ads in the New York Times and the Washington Post and other newspapers across America for a concerted period of time over and over and over again, or buying television ads. And there's a lot more transparency around these kinds of political ads. The funders have to be clearly identified if it's clearly a political ad, and there are all kinds of regulations around that. There are no such regulations right now around any sort of ads on social media companies. And these internet online tools are far, far cheaper. And the information travels exponentially faster. So we have this confluence, this combination of the speed and efficiency of information, and on the other hand, how cheap it is to get access to it.
So, Alina Polyakova, are we at a watershed moment then? Because up until now, the social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, etc., have seen themselves as sort of neutral platforms for people to post personal things, now for news. And now we're seeing a lot of that news was fake, was false. So we're seeing now something called the Honest Ads Act. It's a legislation sponsored by bipartisan senators that would mandate that election-related online advertising be subject to the same disclosure and disclaimer requirements as similar ads in other broadcast media. So that would require these platforms to redefine themselves and to come to terms with the fact that they are really not the neutral platforms that they purport to be.
I think that's exactly right. The legislation you mentioned, I think, is probably a step in the right direction. I mean, clearly, most of our news consumption is happening more and more online. That comes out very clearly when you ask people, where do you get your news? Most people get their news online. A lot of people get their news on Facebook. And so I think these companies should be subject to the same regulations when it comes to political ads as other types of media companies. But again, specifically political ads were just one small part of what we saw the Russians do on Facebook. A political ad is this very narrowly defined piece of information. It has to clearly be advocating for a political candidate. And what we saw when Facebook released some of the sample ads that they said were Russian sourced is that they really made no reference to either Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump. They made reference to very divisive social issues about race and immigration and religion and all of these things that were very clearly part of our political discourse during the presidential campaign as well. And how do you get at that is a much more difficult question. And I think what you're pointing to, Carol, is that these companies have been calling themselves as platforms, not publishers of content, not producers of content, but these neutral platforms. And I think the way they justify that self-labeling is because they have these automated algorithms, right, that have no human element. So the reason why you see some stories in your newsfeed is because Facebook says, oh, look, we're trying to give our users what they want. You know, so if a user really likes reading about gun control or watching kitty videos, right, you will see more and more of that in your own newsfeed. And that's because of the way the algorithm works. But what we saw in the revelations around Russia's activities on these social media companies is that these algorithms can be manipulated. So you can create a bunch of fake accounts that will push up certain content or others. So you can manipulate how the algorithm works in terms of the content it pushes up into people's news feeds so people see it more, etc. And I think now is a reckoning point for them. It is a watershed point if they take this seriously, because they will have to rethink this entire model. I could see a scenario where Facebook will eventually need to have something akin to like an editorial newsroom that you have at major newspapers or television stations, where they employ real people and have to introduce the element of humans into their automated algorithm to once again be able to better judge, is this a fake account or is it a real account? Is this content biased? Is it trying to manipulate people? And you need that human judgment. You can't really do it with these so-called neutral algorithms.
That is absolutely correct. And right now we're seeing that they want it both ways. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Alina Polyakova. She's the David Rubenstein Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Tatiana Voroshko, Senior Editor in VOA's Ukrainian Service. We're discussing Russia's disinformation campaign in the 2016 U.S. elections, how Russians linked to the Kremlin turned social media sites, especially on Facebook, into platforms for bogus news stories and divisive political ads. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to loyal listener Kabu Allen John from Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page, which is absolutely authentic. And now a question from my colleague.
Alina, do you believe the time has come to redefine those platforms as mass media and with all the framework, with expectation, legislation coming with it?
I think it may be a little too early to jump to that conclusion. I mean, these companies are different than traditional media companies or different than VOA. They're not like the New York Times. They don't actually produce content. They're right about that. On the other hand, they become so influential in our thinking, in the shaping of opinions and attitudes, that unless they voluntarily come to the table and maybe agree to something like a voluntary code of conduct in the industry where all the companies are included, then I think regulation is almost inevitable. But I think it's going to be a different kind of legislation that will need to be designed. They'll probably draw on some of the elements from traditional media, particularly on the political ads, being transparent about the funding behind those. But these are different animals than your traditional media. And so I think there's going to have to be some rethinking on the congressional side, on the policymaker side, as to what to do without driving these companies out of the United States, frankly. I mean, we don't want some of the largest companies on our stock market to relocate because of overregulation. So I think the best option would be for them to think through a willing, voluntary option that would be a real option and not just these Band-Aid style solutions that would appease congressional members and the U.S. public.
And as you said earlier, Alina Polyakova, the Honest Ads Act, if implemented, would still not address the fundamental problem that we saw last year, the meddling by the Russians, and that was that it wasn't so much in the ads, but rather in the fake news stories that circulated and were tweeted and retweeted online. It doesn't really address fake accounts or fake news.
That's exactly right.
Well, speaking of the larger issue about Russian interference, as I'm sure my colleague Tatiana knows, as you do, I mean, this is not the first time the Russians have been doing this. We're just targets. That is, here in the United States, we've seen it in Ukraine, we've seen it in Europe. We've seen Russia's attempt to destabilize democracies growing more and more, the desire to create chaos. And as you said earlier, Alina, this is easy, you know, much easier and cheaper just to create chaos, much harder to address it, you know, as a democracy. So the bigger question, of course, is how do we thwart Russia's growing capacity to use digital tools to interfere, to reach into foreign affairs in a way that just wasn't possible before the internet era, to sow instability, to undermine democracy around the world?
You know, I think there's a lot of confusion in the United States right now on that specific question. On the one hand, of course, official Russians, including the foreign minister and other Russian officials, denied any of these activities. President Putin has denied this himself. And so how do you start a conversation with a country that attacks your democracy, attacks the sovereignty of your country, tries to interfere in the electoral process, but then doesn't admit to having a part to play in that at all? So that's question number one. So I think the other question is, if we can't really talk to the Russian government and, you know, get them to come to the table and find some sort of code of conduct or agreement or rules of the game on cyber issues, on information security issues, which I don't think we can, what can we actually do in terms of policy to address these so-called non-conventional political warfare kinds of attacks? I think that is a very new phenomenon in some ways. I mean, clearly propaganda is nothing new. The Soviet Union was very much engaged in launching propaganda campaigns that implicated or said alleged the United States as from doing everything from starting the AIDS-HIV epidemic to killing babies in third world countries, all of these ridiculous lies that were debunked eventually. But now, again, there's a very different digital environment. Entire consumption practices around information have changed so dramatically that I don't think congressional members and lawmakers have really come to terms with what that will mean. And specifically, one new development that I think we saw in the U.S. elections was this merger between cyber hacking and disinformation. Of course, I'm referring to the theft of emails from the DNC and from various Hillary Clinton campaign operators, and then the leaking of that information online, and then spinning that leaked information into all kinds of disinformation, conspiracy theories, etc. How do we respond to that? I think that is a very uncomfortable reality, and it's a major question that policymakers still haven't quite figured out what to do with.
Well, I think the first step is to recognize that Vladimir Putin's Russia, not the Russian people per se, but Vladimir Putin's Russia is a serious threat, and it's difficult to discuss because they will never share, you know, the same rules of the game. They're not governed by the rule of law. It's an autocracy. Propaganda reigns. No network is independently owned. All electronic media are owned by the Kremlin and operated. And that leads me to one more quick question, which is so-called RT, Russia Today. Russia Today is their television channel. It actually operates here in the United States. It's a Kremlin-backed and financed network. It operates relatively freely, if I'm not mistaken, in the United States. And you have written about the fact that perhaps it should actually be registered as a foreign agent, because in reality, it is not a neutral or unbiased source of news, although it appears to be. It's really a propaganda organ of the Kremlin. So could that be one first step to rethink how we allow Russia Today to operate here in the United States, masquerading as a news network, but in reality, a propaganda organ of the Kremlin?
All the things we've been discussing so far in the online space are just part of a much bigger issue. There is this ecosystem of disinformation that the Russians have grown and developed. And RT, which is a broadcaster, along with Sputnik, which is another clearly Russian-sponsored media outlet, are part of this ecosystem disinformation, as are the troll factories, as are the bot accounts, all of these other digital manifestations of these actors we've been talking about. So I think we have to think of our response in those layers as well, right? There's the social media manipulation, these fake accounts, and all of that, how to respond to that layer. And then there's the official Russian government, quote-unquote, news agencies, and how to respond to that. I think the potential option you mentioned that I've also written about, as you said, of forcing RT and Sputnik to register under FARA, it would not prevent these organizations from operating in the United States. It's interesting, RT has actually responded to this proposal, and they have basically said that, look, the U.S. wants us to register as a foreign agent. This is an infringement on First Amendment rights and free speech. Well, this is all a bunch of nonsense. Registering as an agent of a foreign principal under FARA just means you get that label, And it's not that this is, you know, a red mark where you have to display this label on every single, you know, news story, quote unquote news story that RT puts out. But on the public record, it will clearly identify these organizations as what they really are, which are propaganda arms and not the BBC or the PBS or even VOA or VRL. They're not independent from the Kremlin. They're not independent from the Russian government. But they would still be able to function, and that would not in any way infringe on free speech rights.
Right. And I just want to quickly say, too, any kinds of comparisons to VOA or BBC, that is between RT and VOA and BBC, are absolutely spurious. We are democracies. The UK, the United States, we're governed by the rule of law, and even our government-funded broadcasters adhere to journalistic codes of conduct, ethics, and standards. And we're not given instructions by the White House or Congress. We act responsibly to present various opinions in a responsible manner in U.S. foreign and domestic policy. So very different from the way the Russians want to portray us.
Well, that's exactly right. I think it's a really important point. It's not just about ethics, which, of course, is very, very important. It's also that there's transparency in the funding structures of all of the Western organizations that you just listed that doesn't exist for the RT or Sputnik. There's no independent board, for example, that was established by the Russian government. We have no idea how much money they get, how exactly they're funded. This is all very transparent in the case of the BBC, PBS, easily found out by anybody who's curious. And there's just not at all the way that RT and Sputnik are structured.
And that's the problem, because many Americans watch it and they think that, you know, this is a real news channel, when we know, in fact, it is not. So that should be flagged somehow. And let me now turn to Tatiana for another question.
If we're talking about Russian capabilities, Russian capacities, if anyone knows well what Russia can do, are Ukrainians. And
that's
what
right.
The United States here, people learn right now, people in Ukraine knew a few years ago, and they actually tried to warn, for example, Pavlo Shymki, the deputy head of the presidential administration, saying now that he tried to reach top management at Facebook and warn them about. Do you believe that Ukrainian experience was dismissed and underutilized in the United States?
Yes. You know, I often say Americans, including policymakers, American citizens, I think we're very much taken by surprise by Russian interference in our elections and their penetration, infiltration of our social media platforms. I think if we were paying attention to what the Russian government was doing in Ukraine, we would not have been too surprised. Because the Ukrainians have been experiencing Russian disinformation attacks at a much, I think, greater scale for decades. You know, I think one of the first election meddling efforts that the Russians carried out that was found out was in the 2004 elections in Ukraine. Now, that was, at this point, 13 years ago. Since then, Russian capacities and capabilities have become more sophisticated. They've learned how to carry out these kinds of covert operations in a more coordinated way. And that's part of what we experienced in the United States. But again, what the Ukrainians experience now in terms of attacks on their financial sector, attacks on their electrical grids, other critical infrastructures, where they're basically taken down all the time by agents of the Russian government, this could be what might happen in the United States or other Western democracies in the very near term. So I think the sooner that Western countries start looking at what kinds of capabilities the Russians are testing in Ukraine, also Georgia and elsewhere, the better equipped we'll be to prepare for what might hit us next.
Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, said protecting the community of users is more important than maximizing profits. We will see in the weeks and months ahead if, in fact, that is true. We will be putting his statement to the test.
That's right. I hope he's serious about that.
Alina Polyakova is the David Rubenstein Fellow for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution. Alina, thank you for your great work, and thanks so much for your time and insights on the program today.
Thank you, Carol. Thank you, Tatiana.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Zubair El-Tayeb. Joining me on the program was Tatiana Voroshko, senior editor in VOA's Ukrainian service. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.